You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. That is me. I am your host, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams. Stop dieting so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. That is my goal for you. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you would like to call in today and talk with me, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. I would love to hear from you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, emotional eating, any kind of unhappy, unhealthy relationship with food, the real problem is not food. The problem is what is eating at you and what is weighing on you. So give me a call and let me know what is on your mind. And if you're on Instagram, you can also drop a question in the comments. Okay, so I have some questions from people. I'm trying to think about which one do I want to talk to, do I want to address first. Here's one. You know, people eat every day. It's a fact of life for some, but for others like me, it's a living nightmare. Why is that? Why is that? Well, that is a very broad question, and I think if I distill it down, that question really comes to why am I using food emotionally? Why am I, why am I using food emotionally when other people don't? Here's the thing. Remember, why food? Someone once asked me, actually, she said to me, why food? Why am I addicted to food? Why can't I be addicted to meth? At least I'd be skinny. This is what she said. And she was serious. She was just like, at least I'd be skinny, as if meth would be preferable to using food to cope. And that is really what binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating is. It is not a food addiction. It is not any of the things that you think it is, willpower, control. It's not about that. It is a way of coping that hurts you more than it helps. So why food in the first place? Really important to remember that our first experience of relationship, of safety, of having our needs met, of being connected to another person is when we're infants, we're babies, and we're being held in a parent's arms, and we're safe, and we're warm, and we're comfortable, and we're just in this blissful state, and we're being fed. And so that's why in our unconscious minds, not that we think of it consciously, but in our unconscious minds, food equals relationship. When we talk about comfort food, we're really talking about wanting to be comforted by someone else. So for the person who wrote this, why is it a living nightmare? I guess I'd want to know more about the situation. But basically, food is a solution to the problem. People say they have a food problem, an eating problem, a sugar problem, a whatever problem. They have a problem self-soothing, a problem dealing with feelings, a problem with coping and being, supportive of themselves. So often we attack ourselves when we really need support and kindness. Josh is saying, what did we think of mom's unconscious? Well, we can't really discern mom's unconscious unless we think about things like projective identification. I'm getting a little bit in the weeds of psychoanalysis here, but unconscious is hidden from us. We don't know it, and we can't really pick up on the unconscious of others except in certain areas, such as what's called projective identification. When someone sort of disavows, like say, they think that they are ugly. They think they're ugly in some way, but they don't want to think they're ugly. They want to think, you're ugly. So they project the ugliness out to you, and you all of a sudden are like, oh, I'm so ugly. That's a terrible example, just a terrible example on my part. But let me give a better example. It's from a paper that was written about this, and this psychoanalyst, I forget who he was, but he wrote about this, and he saw a patient for the first time he ever met her. She came in and she was talking about, in very matter-of-fact tones, the death of her son. But it was like she was talking about the weather. And the analyst began to feel an overwhelming sense of grief, an absolutely overwhelming sense of grief about this boy that he'd never met and was just now hearing about for the first time. What happened? The mom, who was just perfectly flat and, you know, not talking about it with any kind of feeling because she disavowed her feelings, was unconsciously projecting her grief into the therapist, who then identified with it and felt it. So if you ever have a feeling like, this is not me, why am I feeling this? Or you get an idea about yourself that just isn't how you normally feel, think about this concept of projective identification, because we often identify with other people's projections without realizing it. So that is just a quick little off-topic psychoanalytic lesson, but it pertains to relationship with food, because if you then don't have the wherewithal and the coping skills and the strategies to deal with uncomfortable, difficult, painful feelings, whether they're your own or you're identified with someone else's projections, then what are you going to do to cope? Maybe you're going to turn to food. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dr. Nina. It's Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Oh, Brian from Chicago. Hello. Thanks for calling. It's good to hear from you.
Good to hear your voice. I hope you and yours are doing okay.
Everyone's doing well. My younger daughter's
good.
I just have to say this. Shout out to my younger daughter who just started her first day of in-person school. She is so excited. And it's high school. 13 years old and going to high school. How is this possible? Anyway, that was just me having a proud mommy moment. What's going on, Brian?
So, thank you for always being there and for, you know, providing this form so that we can learn some things all together as a community. And it's kind of in that regard that I'm calling, because obviously, even with, you know, the rise of the various variants to COVID, the world is slowly reopening a bit. As you mentioned, people are going back to school. Businesses are starting to reopen. People are going out a little bit more to restaurants, even starting to grapple with getting on planes. And just from an emotional perspective, I find myself frequently feeling, you know, alternately anxious, angry, and resentful at people who don't get vaccinated. Those people who might have a medical reason where the vaccine, they just can't take it for medical, legitimate medical reasons. I do understand that. I would say that there's a few of them, but that's certainly not the vast majority of people who are refusing to be vaccinated. This has become this strange sort of social political issue. But nevertheless, the phrase that keeps popping in my head is, you know what, it's your turn to stay home. I feel just the deep unfairness of these folks not being vaccinated and yet walking around in restaurants and, you know, walking around public places with no thought as to whether or not they could or could not infect anybody else. They don't frankly care. And you know, just the anti-science bias and the political far right weirdness of it all. I just find myself, you know, and I know we're not here to debate that stuff, but I just find myself sort of upset and, you know, just emotionally upset that these people are sort of heedlessly impacting all of us. And I just wanted to get your thoughts, like what do we do with those feelings?
Oh, that is such a great question. And I completely relate. Absolutely. So to answer the question, it's really, what do we do with our feeling? What do we do with our feelings, and what do we do about the situation? What we do about the feelings is we have to express them, as with everything. If we don't express it, it's not like we put them away or drop them or forget about them or positive think them away or anything like that. We have to express what we feel. Now, that does not mean going up to a person who doesn't believe in vaccinations and saying, "You are such an effing idiot," or whatever it is that you want to say. But that you were mad and scared. So it's important to express your anxiety to a friend, to me in this case, for yourself, to a friend, to other people. There's getting feelings out about other people does not mean challenging those people. First of all, it could, but it doesn't have to. What's most important is that you get the feelings out. You could have feelings about people dead. So to express that anger, to give it a voice, go on page 45 of the Binge Cure, and I have all these prompts for any feelings: anger, anxiety, loneliness, guilt, different feelings, and it's to help people express what they feel. So you just sort of finish the prompt. I'm annoyed because of this. I'm frustrated because of that. I'm angry because of this. I'm enraged because of this. And you say it. And I think it's good to say it aloud, even if you're by yourself, because there's something more helpful about expressing something with affect. So there's a difference between saying, for example, "I'm really annoyed at those anti-vaxxers," and saying, "Oh, I am so annoyed at those anti-vaxxers." One of them is more of a thought, and one of them is a thought plus the expression of the feeling.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I've heard you say that before, but I haven't thought of it that way, where it's the affect of it.
The affect is crucial. Otherwise, you're trying to think away your feeling. It's the difference between saying, "I'm really sad," and crying. Crying gets the feeling mm-hmm. out. Not that you always have to cry when you're sad, but that's an example of how we need to express feelings. We need to, their emotions are felt. That's why they're called feelings. We feel them in our bodies, and that mm-hmm. has to come out and be expressed, whether it's just for ourselves or with others and all of that. So that's part of it. And I, one of the things you're not saying, but I'm wondering about, is it can make you feel really helpless, mm-hmm. really, really helpless when you can't reason with someone who is just so scared, who's just bought, drank the Kool-Aid, who believes what they're reading, who's been told not to trust the vaccine, who's just in that mindset and digging their heels in. They're not really interested in a discussion. They're just scared, or they're just adamant. And it can make you feel really helpless. How do you reach those people? What can we do? What's going to happen with the virus, right? All of this helplessness and powerlessness, as well as anxiety. So I wonder about that as well.
Yeah, no, that's definitely there, because, you have to grapple with the fact that you can't reach them. There is no basis to be able to say, "Let's talk about how you feel about this. Let's talk about what it is that angers you about it or makes you feel afraid of it," but you can't, there will be no conversation about it with so many of them. And so you really are kind of grappling with these feelings either by yourself or with others who already feel the same way you do. And so you can just sort of, and to each other, I guess that's helpful with the feelings. I think the weird thing about this, at least for me, is that the feelings then just get renewed the next time you go out, because you're seeing people who are conducting themselves in a way where it's, you can't necessarily tell who's been vaccinated and who hasn't, but the news is replete with stories and, you know, footage of the latest angry person to walk into a store with no mask and scream at people who are masked and call them cheap and call them libtards and snowflakes and God, I don't remember all the names that get thrown around, you know, and that's just daily. And so it really, for me at least, it does kind of become this weird hamster wheel of venting the feelings, feeling the feelings, acknowledging the various feelings of helplessness and fear and anger and resentment, and then kind of trying to cope with it, get it out. And then in the morning, you're going to get on the wheel again because the situation hasn't and most likely will not change. That's the hard part.
Yeah, and that's and for some people, that sense of helplessness over the situation and what's going on in the world can be transferred to helplessness over food, by the way. So instead of, oh, I feel so helpless about what's happening with the virus and with the anti-vaxxers and with all of this and there's nothing I can do, it's, oh my gosh, I'm so powerless over food, which is something you actually do have the potential to have power and feel empowered with. Just in a, as an aside, and then I the other thing is, well, what do we do about the situation? And part of it is really hard, which is it's easy, and of course, it's easy to say, what's wrong with these people? Why do they believe this? How can they, why are they thinking this? Why don't they listen to science? What are they talking about? Children, like, you know, all of that. What's hard is to kind of reduce it to, okay, they're afraid. And if you ever end up talking to somebody, like, to speak to the fear. And because if you say, don't be ridiculous, there's nothing to be afraid of, they're not going to say, oh, I'm being ridiculous, there's nothing to be afraid of, and then listen to you. But if you say, wow, I really hear how scared you are that this vaccine is going to do damage to you, really hear how afraid you are, that you're scared. Are you interested in some facts? May or may not be. But that, I think that is the way to get people that will bridge the gap between the people who are terrified and the people who are terrified of the people who are not getting vaccinated, is to really bottom line it. Like, what is it that's motivating them?
Right. And I fully get that for vaccines, right? Because, I mean, there are segments of various communities that have history with vaccinations. You know, the African-American community in this country, there is a very clear demonstrable history of the way that people were abused by the United States government with vaccines that were essentially administered to them like they were experimental lab animals. And so that history is in their mind, you know, in many instances, and I absolutely understand that hesitancy. But I guess even when you get down to something like masks, and again, I know that this is not a political show, but I don't know that anybody is afraid of wearing a mask. And this is where my resentment starts to build, because I'm much more empathetic if someone is like, look, I'm really afraid of the vaccine. The vaccine was brought together in a swift manner. And what if something isn't right with it? You know, I understand that completely, that anxiety and how all of us, if we feel that way, have to balance that with the immediate threat of COVID. But with a mask, you know, you're not going to suffocate to death in a mask. So there's no fear there. And that's where feeling of resentment and helplessness in the face of people who are just like, I'm not going to wear a mask because liberty. You know? I mean, I have no idea where to put that.
Okay, so that's logical. It, what you're saying is logical. A mask is there to help, you know, protect you and your fellow human beings around you. That's logical. What motivates people is psychological. For example, I'm not going to let an authority tell me what to do. I'm rebelling against the authority / parents. So people see they don't consciously think of it this way. They just think of it as, I won't be told what to do, you know, or whatever it is that they think, but unconsciously, or on some level, it's a rebellion against an authority. I won't be told what to do. The government represents parents. We rebel, then they rebel against the parental authority of the government.
Right.
You know, and that, so that, that's why.
Yeah. It's just, I'm laughing because I'm thinking of these people that I'm not going to listen to authority when they tell me to put on a mask while I'm standing in line politely at a grocery store, because that's what people tell me to do. And I will stop at the red light when I drive home, and I will put on my seatbelt and won't drink while I'm driving, all of which told to us by authority, but those are okay. It's just, yeah, this is where my resentment and feeling of helplessness comes in. And I know we're getting political and we absolutely don't need to, but it's just absolutely maddening.
It is maddening. And when I say that possible psychological explanation, it's an mm-hmm. explanation. It isn't meant to condone yeah. it or to agree with it. It is maddening.
No, totally.
It is scary. And yeah. people's liberty, you know, people don't have the right to drink and drive because it affects other people. Yes, Ariel is saying feeling helpless is the worst. And so what do we do besides saying, oh, this is how helpless I feel? Remember in your life areas where you are not helpless, where you do have a sense of efficacy, where you can speak and be heard, or where you can do something and feel a sense of accomplishment and resolve. That helps mitigate the sense of helplessness, and think about the ways that you might create a dialogue with someone. If you know someone who's an anti-vaxxer, I don't know if you I'm guessing you probably don't, but if you do, maybe there's a way to even if you reach one person, because that one person can reach multiple people. And that gives you a sense of, hey, there's something I can do. I'm not a helpless victim of people who are making choices based on nonsense that they're reading on social media or getting,
right.
Getting from wherever.
Yeah. I mean, I'll share with you that I don't believe I know any anti-vaxxers, which is also a little bit part of the scary thing, right? Because, you know, unless you ask somebody that you know whether or not they have received the vaccine, you don't know if the person standing next to you within 6 feet of space is or is not. And that's also part of what makes, I think that really the theme of this call is, let's all be cognizant of the fact that re-entering the world right now, yes, it's something we've all waited for. We're all, honestly, I mean, I still feel like a child at the holidays when I'm in the presence of other people who are not my immediate family, because it's like an exotic trip to a faraway land. It has been so long. But at the same time, we're all going to feel some level of just anxiety about, what is this world that we're re-entering? You know, is it safe? Is it the world that we left behind? I don't think it is. So I think that we're all kind of entitled to sort of check in with ourselves, as you encourage us to do and guide us to do, as we go, because.
Yeah. And check in and, oh, are you there? Brian? He's gone. Okay. He's gone, but I will say, got disconnected. Okay. I will say, yes, it is so important. Whatever it is that is going on with you is so important to identify, acknowledge, validate, and then reassure yourself. Ariel is saying it's frustrating to feel out of control. It triggers other things. Exactly. It can trigger a trauma response. Often when we are traumatized, we feel completely helpless. So when we feel helpless, it brings back the old traumas. And again, I really want to stress that there are two kinds of traumas. There's the huge, bad, awful thing that happens to you, that is, you know, being sexually assaulted, being in a car accident, some terrible thing happening to you. And then there are the 1,000 small cuts. So that one big trauma is like, you know, it's like a stake, it's like a hatchet to your heart, trying to think of a big enough weapon. And then the other kind of trauma is like 1,000 small cuts. One small cut doesn't hurt so much, but 1,000 small cuts hurt a lot. They're as traumatizing as the one big wound. When we feel helpless, it can remind us of our trauma, re-traumatize us, and bring up all the feelings from the past. That's what PTSD reactions are in complex PTSD, is you feel in the present what you felt. And you can feel that whether or not you actually have PTSD or complex PTSD. So Josh is saying, what is feeling out of control remind you of from the past? That is a great question, because what happens is we get triggered. We are overwhelmed with feelings. We often feel as helpless as we felt then, especially if it happened when we were children. And then you're vulnerable to using food to cope, to distract, to numb, to another way people use food is to feel sort of heavier unconsciously. To feel like if you're bigger and heavier, you're not small and vulnerable. So there are so many different ways that the way that we feel affect what goes on with food. And that's why if we just focus on, well, what are you eating? You get nowhere. You're plucking weeds and hoping that they won't grow back. They will, until you get to that root, whether that root is a big T trauma, a small T trauma, or some unresolved relationship, or some difficulty in responding to yourself, being kind to yourself, loving to yourself, comforting yourself. If you don't comfort yourself, you're going to use comfort food. Ariel says, or with purging, trying to expel the trauma or anxiousness rather than trying to expel the trauma or the anxiety rather than feel it. Exactly. Yes. Thank you, Ariel. That is so true. Bulimia is so symbolic, right? We can look at it as, you know, you're trying to get rid of something, that you don't want. Symbolically, it could be about needs and wants. So can binging without purging. Like if you don't have your needs and wants met in other areas, if you don't have the kind of relationship you want, the kind of job you want, the kind of sense of being in the world that you want, well, maybe you feel, again, theme is helplessness. You feel helpless about that. Nothing you can do, especially if it's, you know, midnight and you can't go out and, you know, change your life. Turning to food is a way of getting more of something. If you don't have more of what you want in life, you can always have more to eat. That is why I really encourage you to look at, oh, new caller, hold on, hold, let me finish this thought. That is why I really encourage you to look at the symbolism of what is going on with food. Hi, caller, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Nina, it's Jenny.
Hi, Jenny. Welcome back. Wow, today is the day of people who haven't called in a while. So I'm so glad to hear from you.
I'm so glad to hear your voice too, live. I've been working, and so I've been missing a lot of shows, which has been very sad. But I'm glad to be here today with you.
I'm glad you're here too.
You've been talking about comfort foods, and I've been like thinking a lot about that. So I've been having weird food cravings.
Tell me about the weird food cravings.
Yeah, like I've been craving things, and I'm sure you know exactly what this is, but I have just thought it's so strange that I've been craving food from like my childhood that I haven't had since I was a kid. And that I'm like, how weird as an adult that I'm craving like these, you know, these foods that I used to love when I was like a little kid, or that my mom would make me when I was a little kid, you know?
Bingo. You just hit on it, right? That your mom would make you when you were a little kid. And what is you've called the show and talked about how you have to take care of your mom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so you just said something about your mom taking care of you by making you these foods. So could that be on some level a sense of being taken care of? Even if you're giving it to yourself, you're reminding yourself of a time when you were being taken care of, when you were being given to.
That makes total sense. It makes total sense. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I just noticed, like, on my grocery list, I'm like, what am I doing with these weird foods? But when I sit, you know, and I eat them on my day off or on a weekend and I'm home, and I do feel like it makes me feel safe.
Yeah.
It definitely is, like, that feeling of comfort is palpable, like, while I'm, you know, nibbling on my Honey Nut Cheerios that I haven't had since I was like 10 years old.
But it's so interesting because during this last year of COVID, or I guess, you know, year and a half, I have heard so many more people say that they have been eating or craving cereal. You know, they've been craving cereal and they never craved cereal before. And now they're craving cereal. And because it brings you back to a simpler time. It brings you back, maybe not everyone had an idyllic childhood, but it brings you back to a time of feeling safe when the world was safe, when people were supposed to be keeping you safe, where it could be associated with so much.
Yeah, it really, I mean, I've wanted to call in and talk about this for a couple of weeks now, because it's really been interesting how, like, a bite of, you know, that cereal just, like, calms my soul. Almost like, remember when I was really into rosé for a long time, because the covet and the taste, and I just felt like, it was like my best friend. And now it's a bite of that cereal, or, you know, something similar. That,
what do you notice, or if you think about it, what do you notice about the times when you want that cereal? Is there anything going on, any commonality? Are you alone? Is it late at night?
It's not late at night, but it's always when I'm alone and I just want to, like, relax, right? Mm. So at night, what I'll do is I'll have a glass of wine to relax, but during the day, I will pull out, like, something, like, one of my comfort foods that I've been collecting.
Okay. The challenge will be then to comfort yourself with words. So you're realizing whether it's rosé to relax and kind of chill out and not be anxious, whether it's, what did you say? Honey Nut Cheerios, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That helps you feel safe and calmer.
Yeah.
So the key is, and believe me, I know that there are people who are listening to this who are nodding, like, oh, yes, I can relate.
Yeah.
I can relate, right? So the key is then to create a way of comforting yourself with words and not with food or rosé.
Mm-hmm.
And to be reassuring with yourself, you know,
like, sometimes you just want a quick fix, like instant gratification. And, like, right now I'm staring at a box of graham crackers. I haven't had graham crackers either since I was a little kid, but I just, like, I had a craving for graham crackers. And now I'm staring at graham crackers and thinking, maybe I'll have graham crackers for breakfast. That'll be an easy way to, like, relax.
Except it's momentary, and then you need more graham crackers and more cereal and on, rather than give yourself, like, for example, think about if a friend was feeling unsafe. Maybe you just heard Brian from Chicago, his call about feeling, you know, upset and scared and anxious and angry about people who are unvaccinated and sort of proudly so, almost. If you could talk to someone who had that idea, you wouldn't say, oh, here, eat this. Here,
you're
have
right.
this.
I wouldn't.
Quick. Eat the graham crackers. You're going to feel better. Yeah. Drink this rosé.
I know.
You would say what?
I don't know what I would say, but I definitely wouldn't offer a graham cracker. That's for sure. Obviously, yeah. And you know what, Nina? Now that you've talked about that, the previous caller, this is also why I turn to these comfort foods, I think, too, because I'm at home a lot because I'm afraid to go out because half the world doesn't want to get vaccinated. I'm trying my best not to get COVID and then, you know, in turn spread it to my friends and family that I love. And so I'm staying home a lot more than I would. And so I'm at home. I kind of, you know, am just like, you know, I'm alone a lot at home. And I do turn to these comfort foods as like I said with rosé, as like a fun, you know.
Because so you have to be
out and about in the world with these people right. that upset me, kind of like isolating a little bit.
And remember, food equals relationship of some kind. So you for you evoke the image of your mom making you breakfast. So even though your mom's not with you, it's like the good mom who took care of you and made you feel safe and made you breakfast is there in a way, and you're not alone and you're eating this cereal or graham crackers or whatever.
Oh, true. Yeah. I feel a strange connection with some of these like comfort food. It's really interesting.
Yes. And guess what? Comforting yourself with words can also be like a quick fix. Because if you use my very, right? My very acronym, validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself. That is a little code for how to comfort yourself. Yes, of course I feel scared and worried and anxious and upset. How could I not? Look at what's going on in the world. Oh my gosh. You know, it is scary. Of course I feel unsafe. You have to acknowledge what you feel without most of us try to not feel that way. Oh, we shouldn't feel that way. Or, oh, it's not that bad. Or, but you have to acknowledge it and then reassure yourself. Hey, the human race has gone through some really difficult times in the past, and ultimately people do the right thing. And that's on the grand scale. And then for you to remember, you do know how to keep yourself safe. You are vaccinated. You presumably, you know, wear a mask when you go outside. You avoid places where you could get COVID. So you remember how you are keeping yourself safe. Cereal isn't making you feel safe, but actually you're keeping yourself safe, which can help you feel safe.
Yeah. Yeah. All true. All true. And I'm going to try to wean myself off of the cereal by using your acronym, which I did use when I was drinking a little too much rosé, you know. And I was able to cut a lot of the rosé out of my diet. It did work.
Even,
I don't look at rosé the same anymore.
Wow, good for you because you're being kinder to yourself. But we don't want Cheerios to replace rosé. We want you to I want you to be able to respond to yourself and make yourself feel safe without the use of something that you are putting in your mouth, whether you're drinking it or eating it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for caring.
I do care. I do care. And I think just talk to yourself as you would talk to a friend.
I have to remember that. That is such a good way to live life in general. And we tend to be really hard on ourselves. And so I have to remember, talk to myself like a friend.
Yeah. I know you can do it. You are welcome, Jenny. I'm glad that you haven't been able to call because you've been working, because I know that was an issue for a while, but I'm really happy selfishly that you weren't working today and you were able to call in. And if you get a chance again, let me know how you're doing.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye for now.
Bye, Dr. Nina.
So interesting. And the whole cereal thing, so interesting. So if anyone can relate to that, let me know. Josh says, did we agree to eat when we didn't want to? It's hard to have a conversation about food with your mom when you can't talk. This is an excellent point, Josh, because where my mind is going is when I was at the park with one of my kids, and there were a couple of nannies, and they both had babies, and the nannies were sitting on the bench with the babies in the stroller, and I guess there were older kids that were there playing, and the nannies were talking, and they just like, we kept putting bottles of milk in the baby's mouth, both of them. They were more interested in shutting the baby up, it seemed to me, than really meeting their needs. Was the baby tired? Did the baby need to have their diaper changed? Did the baby need a cuddle? Was the baby actually hungry? Anytime the baby cried, two of them, every time these babies cried, they just got a bottle of milk in their mouth. And so to your question, Josh, did you agree to eat when you didn't want to? Well, if you're that baby and every time you cry, someone gives you food, what you learn is anything that you feel that is uncomfortable gets met with food. Food will fix anything uncomfortable. If you are tired, eat something. If you are lonely, eat something. If you are hungry, eat something. If you are thirsty, eat something. You know, whatever is going on with you, food is the fix. That's what the baby learns. And baby stops learning to distinguish what's going on. Baby stops really knowing if they're anxious and need a hug, or they're tired and they need to sleep, or they're thirsty and they need to drink, or they stop recognizing that. All they know is they need the thing that will fix their discomfort, food. And that baby grows up to be an adult going, hey, I'm uncomfortable. What's in the kitchen? So, it's hard to have a conversation about food with your mom when you can't talk. It's hard to have a conversation with your mom about what your needs are when you can't talk. Because you can't say, hey, mom, I'm actually not hungry. I really need just a cuddle. Hey, mom, I'm not hungry. I really just need a nap. The only way that babies have to communicate is to cry. And if the adults around them are not distinguishing what they need or trying to figure out what that cry is about, they're just going to feed them. And then, yeah, the baby eats when baby doesn't want to. So hopefully that answers that question. Okay, I have about 7 more minutes left. If anyone wants to have a quick talk with me, the number's 323-203-0815. 323, oh, that was fast. Hi, caller.
Hi, Dr. Nina, it's Josh. I actually didn't really hear your comment because I was trying to call in. But I was just going to ask you the question I asked you last week, which is basically, how does food relate to the critic? And how does the critic relate to whether we eat or not, basically? That was my question.
But that is a very global question. I think you know you're asking about the critic and food, and really it's on an individual basis. Where did people learn to be critical? And if you're critical of yourself, you can't simultaneously be nice to yourself. Nobody is simultaneously self-critical and self-affirming and reassuring. And so what do people do? they're critical to themselves for whatever reason, and then they turn to food to escape their own mean voice. And that is why it's so essential to look at, for each individual, where did that person learn to be self-critical?
Okay, so if we learned to be self-critical when we were a child, then we would be using food to sort of placate the critic or something like that.
Escape the critic. If you have a critical voice and you're, you know, what does your critical voice sound like, Josh?
I think it sounds like probably, well, very critical. I mean, not willing to have a conversation because at one point, say I couldn't have a conversation. And so it's not really interested in accepting pros and cons and being critical. Actually, you know, the critical voice isn't critical. It's just sort of mean and one-sided. A real critic would be able to weigh, you know, positives and negatives. So I don't think the child was willing to weigh positives and negatives. And then the food is somehow mixed in. And I guess that's my question is, you know, how does the food get mixed in and how can we separate the food from a person who's not willing to have a conversation about anything, who's just so one-sided?
Well, if you have an internal critic, and there are two ways that that people form internal critics. One is when they're criticized and they're judged and they're always told what they're doing wrong. Then they, as much as they hate it, they usually start doing it to themselves. So if someone's always saying, "Oh, you're not doing that well enough," and you're not doing that well enough, pretty soon that person is going to tell themselves, "Oh, I'm not doing that well enough," or "You're not doing that well enough." You're talking to yourself in second person. The other way that people create critics is when they're just left too much to their own devices. There are no boundaries. There's no sense of structure or safety. And they create that by creating a really mean sort of internal critic. So those are the two ways that this critic appears. First, it's being able to identify it, right? You identify it. And by identifying it, you innately are suggesting there's another part of you that's not self-critical. And you start challenging this critic. Where does this critic come from? What's another way to think about yourself?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of in meditation, there's a witness. You know, there's a witness to our thoughts. There's a witness to even the dreams we have at night. And this witness doesn't get involved in all the thinking that we have. It's just sort of there witnessing everything. You know, we go to sleep, but we're still awake in some way because we're able to perceive a dream. So the watcher of the dream, the watcher of our thoughts, at least that might be a refuge that we can, a good refuge, as opposed to taking a refuge in a critic and then sort of using food to, like you said, cover up the critic's sort of misbehavior. Yeah.
Escape it. So I like to think of it like this because I like these kinds of visuals. We all need a little bit of a self-critic to keep ourselves in line. We all need a little bit of self-criticism just to keep ourselves sort of morally and ethically in line. However, we have a self, the one that feels and thinks, and we have a critic. And usually the critic is in the driver's seat when it really ought to be like in the way back passenger seat or the trunk or maybe in the car behind us. And we want to be able to give that critic less power, put it in the car behind you instead of having it be in the driver's seat of your life, and to be able to challenge it. Whose voice is it? Is it right? What do you really want to say to it? So that what you refer to as the watcher, which I would say is you, your true self, can start to challenge that critic and take over and then be supportive of yourself. And when you're supportive of yourself, when you reassure yourself, when you are encouraging yourself, guess what? You don't need food to escape, numb, comfort, or do any of the things that it does for you. And that is how
it would be nice. Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to stay in just witnessing, because if you're just witnessing, then you would not sort of unconsciously be swept away by the critic, which obviously is very easy to do unless you, you know, unless you have some practice on subduing this voice.
Well, I look, having a witness is better than being the critic, but I believe in being more than a witness, taking your own side, being a, we're out of time. Let me just finish this. Being on your own side, taking your own side, being supportive, that is much more energetic and helpful than being just a passive witness. So, Josh, I hope that answers the question. We can talk more about it in the future. Thank you for calling in. Thank you to everyone who called in today, Brian and Jenny and Josh. I so appreciate your joining the conversation. That is our show for today. I am here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, or you can where you can listen live, either on LA Talk Radio or Instagram. And you can listen later on Apple Podcasts or anywhere where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating or a review, or both, even better, because the more reviews and ratings that I get, the more it shows up in searches, the show shows up in searches, and the more people I can reach and help. So I would love for you to be a part of that. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful week. Take your own side, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.